there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a podcast that helps empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter who range in age from 16 up to 33 years. Each episode, I'm talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from mental health to climate change, from pornography to bullying. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, the first of our second series, I had the great pleasure of talking with Craig Foster, one of Australia's most respected sports people and human rights activists. Since his Socceroo days, Craig has had an illustrious career as a sports broadcaster, alongside his unwavering human rights advocacy, primarily around multiculturalism, particularly in support of refugees and those seeking asylum in our country. Last year, Craig was elected the chairperson of the Australian Republic Movement, and whilst he is a passionate campaigner for this cause, he is committed to Australia first having an Indigenous voice to Parliament that is enshrined in our Constitution. In 2021, Craig was appointed a member of the Order of Australia and is the current New South Wales Australian of the Year. Sit back for a deeply inspirational talk with the irrepressible Craig Foster on why standing up for human rights is vital to the well-being of each other, our nation, and our global community. Welcome to We Need to Talk, Craig Foster. Thank you so much for coming on, talking about such a vital topic, which is human rights and social justice advocacy. But there's one thing, first up, I just want to thank you for particularly, and that is having you on means that two of my sons who haven't listened to my podcast are now going to listen to my podcast because they are mad soccer buffs.
That's great.
They're mad soccer buffs.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
One of them 2 weeks ago said, he's 21. He said, I've heard you for 21 years. Why do I want to listen to you again? And I said, well, Craig Foster's coming on in a few weeks. And he goes, okay, I'll finally listen.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, give them my best. It's lovely to join you.
Thanks, Craig. Now, first up, okay, wow, I don't know where to start with you. There's so much that you are involved with in Australia in regards to human rights and social justice advocacy. Can I ask, back in 2018, when you were involved with Hakeem's case and you said that being involved with that case really made you realise I have to do so much more and use my platform. And if I can just explain, Hakeem is a professional footballer from Bahrain who was granted refugee status in Australia and detained in Thailand whilst on holidays with his wife in 2018. And this story, of course, is told in your illuminating book, Fighting for Hakeem. So do you think it really happened since then, or have you always had that feeling of social justice advocacy since you were a kid, which I also read?
So what happened with the Hakeem campaign was an inflection point whereby it took essentially what I've been doing for a very long time just into the public domain. And so rather than being well known, if you like, or having a profile and perhaps some level of influence within the Australian football community, which is 5 or 6 million strong, effectively, until we come to World Cups, when we get the opportunity to speak to 15 or 20 million Australians once every 4 years, or perhaps even more broadly, the sporting environment. What the Hakeem campaign did was just really cross over into broader Australia. So nothing changed. Nothing was particularly different. That campaign was one of the, you know, I would say is overwhelmingly the most challenging thing that I had taken on, but it was still in line with everything I was doing. It's just that I wasn't doing it so much in the public space.
Okay, right. So did that make you realise when you saw the impact that the public arena can have on a cause like releasing a refugee, did it make you realise, look, I have to galvanise people here in future? Did it make you do that?
Yeah, did a number of things. Firstly, yeah, because I had to step across some of my own personal boundaries of what I even understood were my capabilities, if you like, and really challenge, you know, what I thought I was able to do. Because in that campaign, you know, at the start, you know, the question I had to ask is, you know, do I have the skills to be able to do this? Do I have the capabilities to be able to do this? Do I have the contact network? You know, can I make this happen? You know, is this possible? And ultimately, you know, once you challenge yourself to that degree and step across those boundaries, it can be quite scary for all of us. But once you start to become accustomed to it, you get used to, you know, what that means, being in that environment, you start to develop a different set of tools. You know, you gain a different level of confidence as well, because here, you know, you're advocating against several governments and royal families, for example, and finding the path through. You now, of course, understand that, you know, you have the ability to do so, and, you know, and also galvanize a huge amount of incredibly brilliant people. You know, I'm not just talking about myself, but and that in itself is also a fundamental part of the capabilities to continue on. And at the same time, it also provides a deeper sense of responsibility. I guess there's a sense that, look, if that can be achieved and that goodwill can be harnessed, you know, what can't we do? Or a better question is, you know, what good can we do? And so what issues am I either currently involved in at that time, which I had been for 15 or 20 years, whether that was First Nations rights, you know, through sport or, you know, in the early times of climate action or, you know, gender equality and the like, you know, how can we utilize this new reality for all of us, this network, both in Australia and around the world, that had mobilized to come together for that? And so you start to ask the question, okay, what more can we do now? And thirdly, what happens is that network starts to ask the question. So in other words, throughout that we worked with, you know, the global infrastructure of Human Rights Watch, of Amnesty, of the Center for Sport and Rights in Geneva, of various people and organizations at the United Nations, and a whole range of grassroots organizations in Australia and around the world, and plus with sporting organizations and former athletes and the like. And then after that, everyone that was involved took tremendous amount of courage and empowerment out of the campaign, and they want to continue to push forward. And what that meant was that they are very often coming to me now in the ensuing years and saying, we want to do this, for example, around Qatar 2022. So it also connected me into this global network of kind of intellectual leadership on particularly sport and human rights, but also more broadly human rights. And that impact, you know, that further, you know, kind of turbocharges the work that can be done. So all of those different elements come together in a campaign like that.
Mm. Fantastic, Craig, because we are a global community, aren't we? We are so much a global community nowadays, particularly with technology in the last 20 years coming to the forefront. And there's no reason why when we stand up within Australia, we don't think of human rights in a global sense. And you're talking about networking. I mean, it's not just networking within Australia now, it's networking worldwide.
Well, further to that, I would go beyond what you're saying is that, you know, we are global citizens. We're Australian citizens, but we must also be global citizens. And I think now in 2023, we're just starting to recover some of that sense as, you know, on the global political scale, for example, you know, the diplomacy of the Albanese government is starting to give Australians a stance. And I hope a small measure of a pride, really, to start to see that Australia can now engage again in the biggest issues of the day internationally, because we should do. And in fact, further to that, I think that we should be leading a lot of these discussions, because we are, in many ways, we have a lot of challenges to confront. And we're doing that this year in terms of going back and really interrogating the start of our country and our history. But we have extraordinary gifts to speak to the world about, and we haven't done that enough. So I want to see us engage more in the international arena. And some of the issues that I work on, I think, are, in my mind anyway, are about kind of polishing some of the and perfecting some of the principles and values we have. That might be democracy, for example. And here we can talk about the head of state and the republic, and multiculturalism and genuine representation and these types of things, because then we can become very much a model to the rest of the world. So it's not just about engaging, it's actually about living and embodying what we want the world to be. And, you know, there's some really important elements when it comes to recognition and, you know, historic injustices and truths, as well as what the future Australia looks like, which go very much to the heart of our national identity on the international stage, being able to say to everyone, this is the way we think, you know, that people should act. This is what we're committed to as a multicultural nation reconciled with its history. And we want to see, and we really stand for these principles of democracy all around the world.
Fantastic. It's a very exciting time in Australia, isn't it? We've got the referendum for The Voice coming up at the end of this year. And then next term, it looks very much like we'll have a referendum for a republic. Well, we will have a referendum for the republic next term. How excited were you when Anthony Albanese and the Labor government got up? Because research does show that the referendums that are successful are the ones that are supported by the Prime Minister and the government at the time. And we know Albanese and the government is right behind both The Voice and a republic. How'd you feel with the change of government?
Well, history shows, I think, when it comes to the referenda, that, of course, you fundamentally need the government of the day in support. And the referendum for the Republic in 99 was the opposite case. And even then, it was a very close vote, which shows the Republican nature of Australians more broadly. But it also shows through the 44 referenda that we've had that, in fact, bipartisan support is also extremely important. And so that's what I think a lot of people focused on this year, to make sure that both major parties, you know, and independents and the Greens and others are all in support of The Voice. And that's what's going to be important around the Republic. We really need everyone on board. How excited was I? Well, I'm excited about the future of Australia. And whichever government or prime minister happens to be prepared to bring that to life, you know, they have my support. Well, provided that, you know, they fundamentally uphold human rights and a whole other range of things. But I'm pleased in relation to the refugee sector, for example. We are seeing really important steps forward there, whilst not enough. And, you know, every element or cohort of refugees that are left out of the progress, if you like, you know, are people that are deeply at harm and at risk.
Traumatised, yeah. So absolutely traumatised. Yeah. In my past life, I worked as a mental health registered nurse before I became a sociologist. So I looked after a number of refugees that had been in offshore detention in Brisbane.
Yes.
We live in Sydney now. But I could see the trauma and the distress and everything, the panic attacks that were being caused by our inhumane policies. And I went out and spoke at rallies, et cetera.
Right.
And I just thought, this is so inhumane, because we were looking at them as the other. They're not the other. Mm. It could be us.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been us born in these countries and hopping on a boat, really. And you can totally understand them fleeing in that way.
Yeah, well, you know, Australians, because of our history, you know, where the country is accepted to have actually been invaded now, and that's why, you know, a First Nations call 26th of January Invasion Day, and I think that's become normalised and largely accepted now. And so we're now starting to accept the truthful elements of our history and really discover it as older generations, because we were never taught this. Something that, you know, I'm delighted about, but I'm also aggrieved about the fact that, you know, we didn't grow up understanding these things. I would have loved to, most Australians, I think, would have much preferred to have had the truth of our history as part of our education system. And we feel that if that was the case, all of us generations in the last 30 or 40 years, we would have been able to make a much, much greater impact earlier. Well, I think the overwhelming majority of Australians all understand now, because we've been on this journey with First Nations bringing us to the truth of our country, you know, by protesting on Australia Day, by calling it Invasion Day, by really challenging Australia to deal with our with the denialism of our history, with the untruths of our history. That's been important to put us, I think the majority of Australia, in a position where we're now inspired to understand what exactly happened, because we know that it's going to lead to recognition, to reconciliation, to be able to come together ultimately with First Nations and walk this path together. And that has to be the future of Australia. There's no question that we have to look back in order to go forward properly. You know, 235 years later, with the conditions that Indigenous Australians are still living in, with the mistreatment that they and disadvantage that they're still experiencing, and with the racism that they experience, we have to deal with the beginnings of contemporary Australia. And by doing so, we can actually create a unified future where we are deeply proud, along with First Nations, of their 65,000 years history, not just to use it and appropriate it and say, look, this is the oldest living culture on earth, and we're really proud of that as Australians. Well, we can't be deeply proud of it until First Nations are standing with us in that conversation. In other words, we're all standing together saying, as a country, we are proud of it. And we are together in justice and truth. That has to be the foundations of future Australia. And First Nations have done an extraordinary job. The advocacy and the courage, of the over several hundred years, but, the Tent Embassy and all of these issues are all intertwined over this very, very long and tortuous journey to try and get us to a point as a country where we are genuinely together. We can only be really together on truth. And, that's what 2023 and beyond is very much about. Now, you mentioned refugees. The reason I say that is because by dealing with that truth, we then start to understand some of our fear about other people coming to take our country and about our demonization of other and refugees and the like, which has been a cyclical pattern in Australia throughout our post-Federation history. And once we can deal with that, we can then start to expend our, emotional energy as Australians and as a country on, creating genuine representation, genuine equality, a national identity that is truly inclusive of every multiculture, as well as First Nations, and making an extraordinary contribution to the world. And we're going through this process, I might say, at a time when the world is facing extraordinary challenges. And the world needs every country who is democratic, who is genuinely representative, who is genuinely inclusive, who is genuinely anti-racist and multicultural. We need every single one of those examples to be powerful. So, for example, if you look in recent years during the Trump time, particularly when the US lost a tremendous amount of credibility on the international stage as a leader, really, in any respect, at the same time, we've got the rise of Russia and what's happening in Ukraine. You've got Saudi Arabia now doing a deal with Iran recently. You've got China together with Russia. So you've got these coalitions building, which are a very significant challenge to the principles of democracy and human rights, all of them wanting to redefine what human rights infrastructure looks like. And so the question I would have is, which countries on the global stage right now are the most fundamentally powerful examples of the beauty and the importance of freedoms, of democracy, of inclusion? I'm talking about multiculturalism there. And Australia can become that beacon. So we're having these discussions at one of the most important times in modern history.
So we certainly, Craig, need a lot more of that in the world, don't we? And we will be a leader once we have a voice to Parliament, once we have become a republic. We're sending out this fantastic, wonderful, important message to the world that Australia is doing the right thing, that we are upholding human rights. And it certainly needs it at the moment, doesn't it? We certainly need as much of this in our global community as possible to spread this message, not only within Australia to have the well-being of Australia improved hugely, but to send this out to the world, as you were saying. So as the chair of the Australian Republic Movement, you feel strongly that we need to have a voice to Parliament first. So why is it so important to have that before a republic? and how are they connected?
Yeah, so there's a number of points there. Firstly, I believe in the international framework of human rights because it is secular and it's objective. And whilst it's always under challenge, rightly, because of various different ideologies, philosophies, religions, and the like all around the world, it is the best that humanity has been able to produce in terms of saying, putting all of those differences aside, these are the frameworks we agree that every human should have as their basic rights. And different religions take very, very different views on all of those different concepts, whether it's, discrimination, what we would call non-discrimination of LGBTI community, for example, and all of these, or gender equality, all of these elements. You have theocracies, you have governments, you have ideologies, you have different ideas treating each of them differently. And therefore, what the world has rightly done is come together in the center and say, we need a safe space to protect everyone on just on their basic humanity. And so I really strongly support that. Whilst it can develop and continue to change, that's fine. It is the best that the world has come up with right now and is critically important. Now, so Australia needs to ensure that we also respect these rights in order to be something of a contributor, if not a beacon, to the rest of the world. And we have an opportunity to do that because we are one of the most multicultural countries in the world. So we need to go back and understand what these rights are. One of the fundamental rights of people globally is or are enshrined in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples 2007. And what that says is rightly that many of the Indigenous cultures which represent the history of humankind and are incredibly valuable to keep alive and to ensure that they are protected have been wiped out through colonization and other imperial forces and the like throughout human history. And therefore, we need to keep these cultures alive. And the only way to do so is to empower the Indigenous peoples of every country. And empowering means the concept of self-determination. So I believe in that concept very, very strongly. What it means is that, and we've seen this in throughout the history of Australia, that broader Australia, or what used to be, but prior to the multiculturalism that we see today, what actually was white Australia in the first three quarters of the 20th century, which included the White Australia policy, was essentially white Australians saying, this is what we think is in your best interests. And sometimes that intent is benign, other times it is not benign, other times sometimes it is malicious, even vicious, which can be, for example, policies designed for Indigenous people to actually be wiped out, we saw in the 19th century and
during colonization. Yeah,
right. So what Human Rights Instrument says is that in First Nations people here and in Canada and US and in South Pacific and in New Zealand must be involved in decisions that pertain to their culture, to their lives, and to their lived reality. And that is a internationally accepted human rights principle that I think is fundamentally important and in my view can't be undermined. It's just like really straightforward. Of course, if we put ourselves in the same position, say I'm a First Nation person, I've been here, I understand my history and this is what's happened, and now this government again, this other person is coming as an Indigenous minister, they've got different ideas, they don't talk to us, they've never asked us, they never come to the community. And yet here we see this cycle going around and round and round again. So if we just put ourselves in the shoes of First Nations for a moment, it's not difficult to understand the frustration, the anger, the dismay at what's happened. So therefore they need to be involved. So First Nations put together a very
comprehensive,
good word, very comprehensive, great word, thank you. Very comprehensive process of consultation of their own communities and have come up with the Voice to Parliament, which is a non-binding structure to be, to provide advice and be consulted on. But essentially what it does is it just brings to life the right of First Nations people to self-determination. So that's really, really simple. So that's in part answered your question about a republic and a First Nations.
And that needs to happen first, have the enshrined voice first, because I interviewed Professor Mark McKenna, the historian. And 20 years ago, he was talking about how much we've got to become a republic. He still, of course, feels that. But he said, no, we were saying then that's more important than the voice to parliament, but it's not. And he said, we've got to fix what's within ourselves first, the issues of disempowerment for our Indigenous people that happened from colonisation, still happens very much so, first, before we then sever ties with the monarchy. And because severing ties with the monarchy is very much respecting our First Nations people, because look what happened from European settlement, all the horror that happened for our Indigenous people. So they're very much connected. And with becoming a republic, some people say their two causes are separate. So to them, you say, no, we have to do it this way, a voice to parliament first. And then I've had a number of leading advocates from the voice to parliament say, we will support a republic because we're doing it the right way.
Yeah. So what I would say is this, that a republic must be what Noel Pearson called rightly a just republic. And so therefore, my personal belief is that we have to go back in our history to tell the truth about what happened and reconcile with that moment and what's happened since in order to move forward as a country. Now, moving forward as a country means a genuine independence for a number of reasons, which we can explore, but that is definitely the future path of the country. But we can't do that without reconciling with our truthful past. We must walk together into the future, understanding what happened exactly. And we want to know that. And some people say, oh, well, why should we, why should I feel this or I should feel that? And I said, well, you can feel any way you like, but we must have truth. Like, you cannot have a country marching boldly, courageously, and confidently into the future on an untruthful foundation. It is simply not appropriate.
No, no way.
It's not appropriate for First Nations, and it's not appropriate for me. It's not appropriate for you, and it is not appropriate even for the people who are deeply challenged by it. I hope in time Australia will definitely come to understand that we can only come together truly through truth. Is there going to be pain and discomfort and challenge through this process? Of course there is, but we want the truth, and we want to live as Australians with pride, knowing that we have come together on that foundation and we are starting to fix it. So that's fine. The secret, so that's the reality of a republic. So I talk about three things, reconciled, independent, and truly multicultural. So what that means is that we've dealt with our past. Secondly, we now are in charge of our own affairs, and we don't have people as our head of state who, firstly, aren't Australian. Secondly, are discriminatory on a range of levels. Thirdly, are contrary to all the values of our country and all of these things, right? And then thirdly, and importantly, truly multicultural. Now, multiculturalism is about representation and access. So diversity is not multiculturalism. Diversity of Australia means we are one of the most diverse nations in the world, and that's absolutely beautiful. But if you ask multicultural communities what genuine inclusion means, it means representation and access. In other words, we are only truly multicultural when we see that the boards of institutions, of universities, that we see the federal parliament, that we see corporate management, that we see sporting clubs, that we see the diversity of our demography in our institutions, our media, and our parliament, for example. That's true multiculturalism. It what we're saying to, and I'm a multiculturalist as an Anglo-Australian.
Okay? Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah.
Okay. And so what I'm saying is I want to see the Australian parliament represent our gender balance and the intersection of our cultures. And by cultures, it means also religions, of course, because that comes largely with it. Okay, so what saying is when the current federal parliament stood up with the greatest representation of Indigenous MPs in our history and the most diversity, and it wasn't that long ago when I think Ed Husic might have been the first Muslim male Australian MP. Anne Ali was the first female. We're only going back a few years here.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got a, you know, so we've got a long path to tread. But when that happens, I, as an Australian, I'm deeply proud. I'm extremely pleased. Because when I see our true nature start to come out, and I, when I, if I say that an Egyptian Australian, a Lebanese Australian, a Greek Australian, a Croatian Australian, or if you talk about a Baha'i Australian, a Hindu Australian, a Muslim Australian, a Jewish Australian, as well as a Catholic Australian, Christian Australian, if I can tell people around the world that all of these differences in Australia are now represented in our institutions of power, I am deeply proud of our country. At the moment, I am proud that they're here, that we have some social cohesion, which is very high on a global scale, according to the Scanlon Foundation Index, which is groundbreaking research. And so, you know, we're on the path to actually becoming genuinely multicultural. And I happen to think that that is a model to the world. Imagine 15, 20, 30, 50 years hence, when, you know, our Australian head of state is, is a South Sudanese Australian woman.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Is our head of state, or is a First Nation elder who is our head of state. And okay, so we're starting to see these barriers being broken down. So a republic is about, the principles of republicanism are about vesting sovereignty in the people, not in a monarch. And that means that Australians own our country. We own it by ensuring that every single one of us has representation to parliament, and every single one of us has access to institutions of power. So every single Australian can become an MP. You can become a local councillor. You can become a minister in a government. You can become a prime minister, and you can become Australia's head of state. That is the future of a genuinely democratic, truly inclusive, multicultural, reconciled country. That's the answer to what the future looks like for Australia, and why we have to step back and, you know, and walk this path with First Nations of truth in order to get to there.
Yep. Yep. Makes a lot of sense, Craig, and it's fair and just. 1995, Paul Keating, in his famous speech on us becoming a republic, said that the head of state needs to be above politics. But really, it's all political, really, isn't it? You know, becoming having an Australian as our head of state, becoming a republic, shouldn't we be looking at raising the bar of politics more rather than saying that the head of state is above politics?
Well, so the conversation Australia needs to, there's two levels to the conversation. The first is, you know, does Australia need to become fully independent with our own elected head of state? And the overwhelming majority of Australians agree with that. You know, that's really quite a very simple proposition. And given that we're heading into a monarchy, you know, the first coronation in 70 years, it's going to really concentrate and focus the minds of Australians on the fact that we now have a king of Australia who's also king of 14 other of his realms, that most Australians either are completely switched off from, you know, this particular individual, or in fact, you know, have some form of disregard for, you know, Charles personally or as a king. And so, you know, Australia is going to be placed in a position that we haven't been for a very long time, where we see a crown being placed on someone's head who we didn't elect, we didn't choose, we wouldn't choose to, I don't think, to any institution in Australia. And we have an opportunity for the first time in a long time to consider why he's there, what this means, hereditary title, you know, this concept of monarchy, whether we're at all comfortable with it. And finally, we have to consider what that means to First Nations and our history as we're walking this path, and start to say, well, it's no longer reconcilable to, on one hand, talk about stolen land and invasion and reconciliation, and in the other hand, hold the crown. So these two things are no longer reconcilable. And that's different today in our current social context to what it was in 95 when you're talking about Paul Keating's speech. He alluded to some of these elements, but Australia in 30 years has moved a long way in terms of this journey. And so now, as you said before, much certainly the majority, I would say, of First Nations are now saying, in order to walk this journey, we can no longer walk it with the Crown because you guys are starting to understand what happened to us. Okay. And so therefore that's a powerful driver for this discussion about independence. Okay. What does independence look like? That's the second phase question. And so now we'll take a couple of years in the next term of government, or at least 12 months, to talk to Australia, consult with Australia about what type of head of state we want, what the model looks like, and, you know, what the obligations on that person are, you know, what level of accountability, you know, the Australian, us as Australians have towards that position and that person, and what their nature of their responsibilities are. And that's a discussion that, you know, we need to build consensus with Australians. And so we don't want to preempt that discussion. What we do see, and I think we need to avoid as a country, is people immediately going to this nature of, well, it's going to be, this position is going to be political, or this position is going to do this or that. Well, this position can do what Australians agree that it should do. And that's the discussion that we need to have. And we must have, because we own it. So someone, I did an interview just the other day, and someone said, oh, you know, I want to make the focus of the interview, you know, this Craig Foster guy is now the chair, and I hope the co-chair of the Republic, because in the next couple of days we have our special general meeting to have a female co-chair as well, so that, you know, we can share responsibilities.
Terrific idea.
Okay. And so, and they said, oh, is this kind of the guy to bring it to life? And I said, well, no, the answer to that question is no. Don't even get started on the question. The reason is because I don't own it. This is for Australia. Every one of us own the Republic. Republicanism, Republic is about us. It's not about politicians. It's not even about the head of state. It is about sovereignty vesting in us, in you, me, First Nations people, and every single culture in 270 cultures in this country. We get to choose what it is. Now, if we go back to 99, that was the lesson of 99. The minimalist model that was put forward by that, you know, John Howard, who was a monarchist, massaged to put this question to the people, was very easy to pick apart, and it actually split the Republic movement, which ultimately killed the referendum, even though it was very close, even in the end, which demonstrates the Republican nature of Australia, in my view, because in those difficult circumstances, they still almost voted for it.
Yeah.
Right. It was 55-45.
More or less. So close. Yeah. Absolutely.
Close.
Yeah. When you had a leader that was trying to really derail it.
Exactly.
And it was so close. But imagine now when you've got so much consensus and people supporting it, and the Prime Minister and the government.
And also we've got, you know, a different monarch that Australia has no regard for. So we're walking this path with First Nations. We're in a very different place today. What happened in 99 was essentially the model was just saying, just let the you know, just replace the Governor General and let the Prime Minister put someone into that seat, and the Australian people have no say in it. And what the fact that Australia voted no by a factor of 10 out of 100 was because they were Republicans. Because we essentially always have been since you know, pre-Federation. Because what they said was, no, the sovereignty rests in us. We need to be involved in electing that person. We are not comfortable with politicians just appointing someone. And that's very, very interesting, because what it says is that Australians want to have a direct say. Now, there's a broader conversation here about what the roles and responsibilities are, but essentially a head of state is accepted around the world as being an apolitical position, but which has some form of reserve powers to ensure that they hold the government accountable on our behalf. And so therefore an elected Governor General Australian who's accountable to us, the people, could never have allowed the five secret Morrison ministries, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No way.
So these are the discussions that we have ahead of us, and they're inspiring. They're going to be exciting discussions, and we will arrive at a model that the overwhelming majority of Australians agree with and are going to be incredibly proud of when we have our own person there of one of our vast cultural backgrounds, if not a First Nations, a person.
Yes. So what do you see, Craig, as the primary purpose of the Australian head of state? How do you want to see them have an impact on Australia?
So their job is to embody the ambitions, the values, and the future of Australia, if you like. And therefore, they represent us. They do two things. They represent us ceremonially on the international stage. They also are someone who is in a position to ensure that our democracy functions according to the standards that Australians expect. And therefore, their only accountability is to the Australian people. And therefore, they're someone we look to when a government is in a position where they are abusing the principles of democracy, such as Scott Morrison did, by contravening, you know, the conventions of ministries and cabinet solidarity, for example, who are going to call that out and ensure that the interests and democratic principles of the Australian people are protected. They are also someone who embodies Australia on the global stage. And therefore, our head of state goes to the major multinational fora, both sporting and otherwise, and they represent us. They mourn with us, they cry with us in tragedy, and they celebrate with us in triumph. That's what a head of state is. At the moment, we have a head of state who is completely unrepresentative, completely unaccountable. And in fact, whose representative in Australia, the Governor General, has been involved in a very serious contravention of our democratic principles only in recent years by allowing a Prime Minister to surreptitiously, silently and inappropriately adopt five ministries without the Australian people being at all aware of this.
And without the other ministers knowing some of them.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about human rights. You've been in that arena for a long time now. Are you heartened or disheartened by the level of support for human rights in the world and in Australia? And what do you think we need to do to make people stand up for what's right more?
Yeah, so we need, so am I heartened? Not really. I'm very concerned because we have a coalition of countries, whether communist countries or countries like Russia and others, who now want to fundamentally challenge, particularly China. They want to challenge the human rights framework, and they talk about a Chinese version of human rights, which includes social surveillance, which includes total absence of freedom of speech, and all of these things. We have a very big challenge in coming decades in that respect. And it's why countries like Australia are so important that we actually live the principles that we want the world to be. In the Australian context, we are taking some important steps forward with a great deal of difficulty, but we are seeing some talk about social housing, for example, the basic rights that people have to be fed and housed and to be treated humanely. That means that we've seen some advances in refugee policy after 20 years of being in a very awful space. And the language currently of the Albanese government has changed drastically. Oh. And so
we're seeing a lot more humanity and compassion in our parliament with Labor coming in. Just wanting to talk about humanity and extending it. They had the 19,000 who are on TPVs, refugees, now be given permanent visas. Yet, we've got a number of people, doesn't matter how many, but we've got a number of people still in offshore detention. They say they can roam around the island, but they're still in detention when it's only 20 square kilometres wide and it's, horrendous in relation to social supports, et cetera, employment, study. So you've still got that happening. You've still got onshore detention here. So it's not humanity reaching out and saying, well, I'm going to support human rights. It's not something you can pick and choose, is it? You can't say, well, I'll let you stay here permanently, but I'll keep you in detention and use you as guinea pigs to deter people smugglers. It's something that has to be extended everywhere. What are your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so governments all around the world like to disregard human rights often as much as possible. In order to bring to life you know, their particular ideologies. And in Australia, if you notice, human rights has not been a part of our fundamental education, which I think it should be. So when I was a young person, not only was I not told the truth about First Nations, but I didn't understand the international framework of human rights, which I think is crazy. Every human being has a right to understand it. And therefore, you know, so I'm involved in some initiatives, for example, to educate young people through sport and these types of things, to let them, to give them an understanding of within that, within all environments, but within the sporting environment, what are your underlying human rights in relation to disability or non-discrimination and gender equality and these types of things. And so I think education in civil society, in our civic education in primary and secondary school is fundamental, and I would like to see human rights really a central part of that.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Prevention is key, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and to have them understanding it. And what about, you know, courses on compassion and kindness, you know, and to understand these gender expectations, which can tip over into bullying and violence and all this amongst a lot of males, and bullying with females too. We need to have those discussions, do you think, in school, so that we have these wonderful people that are, I'm not saying a lot of people who are leaving school aren't wonderful, but then there will be so many that then understand and want to fight for what's right in this world if we can get those messages when they're young out there.
So what the concept of what is right to for everyone in society is contested across all of the political parties and different ideologies. So the only objective framework in which religions are protected, but they are not determinative, for example, is the human rights framework. And that's why I think it's so fundamentally important and perfect for a secular country like Australia, which is one of the fundamental strengths that we have. That we respect every religion, but all of those religions must be in themselves non-discriminatory to the rest of Australia. So in other words, a religion can believe, you know, what it pleases in relation to LGBTI community, but you cannot discriminate against LGBTI people. That's incredibly powerful part of the social cohesion and the society that is built in Australia. You know, I really, really love it. And so therefore, that's the power of the human rights framework. Now, some of those human rights are often brought to life in domestic legislation. The Racial Discrimination Act 1975, for example, non-discrimination legislation at federal and state level on the basis of gender or other elements and sexuality and the like. Those are effectively, they are basic human rights, but it's just that so what we essentially do as a country is we sign up to the international accords and then we choose whether we want to implement and embed these principles into domestic law. We don't often do that. However, the rights themselves exist for everyone independently globally. So therefore, they are incredibly powerful in a lot of ways, but not many Australians understand them. So when COVID happened, people are saying, well, I have a human right to walk into Bunnings and these types of things. What it demonstrated was that people, aren't well educated. It's very, and I didn't understand them well until I studied them in a law degree. So, you know, I'm very well aware of the journey that we all have along that continuum to understand them. And therefore, they're legalistic. They exist within the legal community and the NGO community and the advocate community, and within government policy frameworks. However, the broader community doesn't understand them. When we understand them, we also can place ourselves better contextually in the global environment. We start to think as global citizens when we understand that refugees have basic human rights. And when we understand what they are, it can condition the national discussion that we have. So I think they're really fundamentally important, and I would love to see all of Australians, you know, understand them further. The only way to do that is to embed them in education at an early age. And I see absolutely no reason why anyone should have an issue with doing so, because they're not ideological. What they are is they are secular, objective, and all they're saying is this is the way that every human being should be treated.
Mm. Gillian Triggs, the ex-Human Rights Commissioner, was saying we need a Bill of Rights here in Australia. Do you support that? Yeah.
Yes, I do. I think we need a Charter of Rights, as we call it, and there are a number of organisations around the country who campaign for that. But one thing at a time.
That's right. We don't want to overwhelm everybody.
No, we don't. We've got big elements on our change agenda. So the main changes that we do need to make, and I congratulate Albo on, you know, this, what is a bold change agenda. And, you know, what he's saying is he wants to do two things rightly. Take us backwards to deal with the beginnings of our modern country post 65,000 years in order to then take us forward as a fully independent, fully inclusive, a unified nation. Those two things are incredibly powerful and go to the nature of who we are and who we want to be. You know, if we bring those two things to life in, you know, let's say the next 4 or 5 years, we fundamentally transform the future of Australia. We let every multicultural community in the country know that they genuinely have opportunity and that they are equal. And we start to, you know, right some of the wrongs in relation to First Nations. It's very, I keep saying to people, we should all be deeply inspired that our generations have been tasked with this big challenge of making these two steps forward. They're natural steps. But, you know, given the history of the country, you know, they are a big challenge for us. And I think at the moment, I feel that we are traversing this immense challenge really quite successfully.
I feel it too. It's such an exciting time to be living in Australia.
Hugely exciting.
Oh, how hugely exciting is it to be part of this? And, you know, it's really just about getting that knowledge out there. That's why I'm interviewing you today, chatting with you, getting the messages out there so people understand the why, you know. And I mentioned to you Simon Sinek, who's an American author, and he has one of the most popular TED Talks talking about what makes a great leader. And people listen to the why more than the what and how. Right. And it's why is we want to do the right thing by our fellow human beings. It's as simple as that, Ryan.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm feeling a sense of, I think that we're being liberated as a country. And so Australia has had to deny the true history of what happened to First Nations, the start of the modern Australia from 1780, from first contact on. It, you know, we've been in denial as a country, and there's a psychological cost to that. And you know, Australia hasn't wanted to discuss these things truthfully and openly and courageously. So over the last, you know, I'm 53. And so throughout my life, what I've seen periodically is when these moments happen, let's take, for instance, the Adam Goode situation. You know, people are demonized, attacked, those who speak up, First Nations leaders who speak out on rights and these types of issues, and try and expose the history that they understood, were routinely attacked, and the rest of Australia, you know, so people couldn't speak about the truth properly. And that type of denial is not healthy for a country.
No, you know, absolutely not.
It's not healthy for anyone.
No.
You know, and therefore, now that we're, I think it's liberating for all of us, you know, because we no longer need to deny. Everyone can talk about invasion. Everyone can talk about stolen land, despite the fact that the High Court in 92 already, agreed with that in law. Now people can use, so these terms have been normalized. And so we're being, in a way, emancipated from these chains that have been on all of our legs. We didn't think so, but they are. And we want to love and respect and genuinely be equal with our First Nations. We want that.
And not only is it great for them, it's great for the whole country, right? It's nation building.
Right. And so Australians are by nature compassionate and giving. We see this when it happens in the floods, and it's incredible what Australians are capable of. But the one thing that we haven't been able to do is to be compassionate and giving towards our own First Nations, who were the traditional owners of the country. And why can't we, why haven't we been able to do that as a culture or even as individuals, is because they've been so demonized and attacked and marginalized and dehumanized because we don't want to talk about the beginnings of the country. We want to walk together with First Nations.
In unity, yeah.
We want to hold them up to the world. We want to be proud of the beginnings of our country. We want to be proud of everyone here, including our 65,000 years. And we cannot truly, okay, we can hold up flags. We can do welcome to countries. You know, we can love Cathy Freeman. That's not true. You know, that's not true respect. True respect is saying to First Nations, we get it. We love and respect you. It was wrong what happened. We know now why you're in the position you're in, and we want to ride it. We acknowledge it. Let's move forward together in equality. Okay. And that releases Australia in an extraordinary way. And by the way, many of the most brilliant people I know are First Nations Australians. And when they are released from that burden of constantly having to tell us what they went through, what they are capable of giving to this country is unprecedented. When we genuinely are able to accept because they want to give to us the best of their historic culture, we don't know where we're going to end up in. Like this is the oldest living culture on earth.
Yeah.
This is a culture based on respect and understanding of land and spirituality. And when we don't even get it yet because First Nations haven't been able to communicate it to us because we haven't listened. We weren't listening.
Yeah.
We're now starting to learn how to listen. The future of this country is incredibly profoundly inspiring when we start to get that right. And then we open barriers for all our multicultural and we say, this is who we really are to the world. This is an incredible country.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. It's an incredible country, but it's not living up to its potential, is it?
Not even close.
No.
Not even close. So, you know, it's an incredible place to be even now, but not for everyone. It is an incredible place for me. Okay. It's an incredible place for me because I'm in the racial cultural majority. Because I played sport where people listened to my voice, but it's not incredible for First Nations. It's not incredible for many of our multicultural communities. We have a long way to go. That's what we talk about, equality.
Yeah, and the other things, living in poverty, homelessness, unemployment, exactly. They're all interconnected. Exactly. And you know, way back when I did my nursing training at Manly Hospital in the early 80s, I remember a lecturer saying, when you understand each system in the body is connected, then you get it. All of these causes are interconnected, aren't they?
That's exactly right.
Because it's all under the banner of what's humane. Finally, I just wanted to ask you, Craig, got to ask you this one. Because of your standing as a sports broadcaster, your ex-Socceroo, do you think that people who have a lot of influence in the sporting areas, in the arts, whether it's acting or singing, do you think they have, if they feel very strongly about human rights, they should stand up and say what they think?
So I think we all have a responsibility to contribute to the common good. And I don't believe that a life well lived is simply accumulating as much as we can for ourselves or our close family, and then passing on. Leaving this place, Australia or the world, and saying that this is what I was able to achieve for myself. It's an empty life. It's not what we're built for. And it's not a part of the broader social structure that we've created. We all have a responsibility to help others around us and to help create a better society, not just for people today. So I want people to have food and a roof over their head. Okay, because I have that and I think it's wrong that anyone in Australia doesn't have that. I want people to be able to avoid violence. I want people to be able to go throughout their lives without facing racism. I want First Nations to know that Australia understands the truth, accepts it, and wants to provide the very best of a future for every Indigenous person in the country. That is what living is about. That is what being an Australian is about.
Yeah.
And when we all leave this mortal plane, we should be able to turn around and say, this is what I gave, not just this is what I accumulated. We all need the minimum in order to get through, but you know, our accumulation is not our value. Our value is how did this person contribute to people around her? And to broader society, is the world a better place through this person having made some form of impact. That's my answer to your question. When it comes to platform and power, well, sport gives us some social power, some social capital, some political power, because, you know, we can mobilize people if we want for refugees or any other cause. And the greater the privilege, the greater the responsibility. It's really simple. And in Australia is a society in which sport and the arts and actors and the like are given incredible, I would say, inordinate amount of privilege. And therefore, the question is, how are you paying that back to society? That we all need to answer that question.
Oh, perfect answer. And look, I always finish with everybody that I have an interview discussion with. Is there something you really want to say at the end here that you feel is so important to say?
I would just say that Australia throughout 2023 with The Voice and beyond, we are learning one really important thing from the gift that First Nations are giving us, is the ability to listen to other perspectives and to hear the truth. Now, the future of Australia is also about attacking racism. And, you know, that's a broader discussion about racism and colonization and even our first Immigration Restriction Act and, you know, and where multicultural communities sit today. But I, being in multicultural Australia as a sports person and now in my midlife, I hear a lot of about racism. I hear a lot about how multicultural communities are treated. And we cannot deal with racism until we can listen to truth. So 2023 and beyond is about being comfortable with listening to the truthful foundations of the country and the way people feel they're being treated here. So by learning that with First Nations, we can also apply it to our multicultural communities. And once we then start to be able to unpack racism and the barriers that people face, we're now on a genuine journey to a truly inclusive multicultural nation. And that's what Australia is destined to be. I might say, finally, we can only be that independently and by ourselves.
Yep, that's true. Okay. Well, look, what a great way to finish, Craig. I thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You must breathe once every 3 minutes at least. but yeah, look, thank you so much for your time. I'll be seeing you soon, I'm sure, with our shared interests. It's been wonderful. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, I hope you were as inspired as I was by this powerful interview with Craig Foster. I hope you'll join me for the next episode of We Need to Talk. And until then, take good care of yourselves and each other. And remember, knowledge is power.